We're on the train of money printing, talking about money printing and fiscal responsibility. Like, if you're a politician, talking about fiscal responsibility of a nation is useful for people who believe in fiscal conservatism. But realistically, that's never going to happen. We all know that money printing is like a drug, and no one's going to commit political suicide by actually cutting government spending and then ruining the economy for a, 2 year period just to have the next 3, 4 years. And then once you're unelected, the next president benefit from, right, the measures that you took. I don't care for Trump to talk about sound money. I know he's going to print. I'm expecting him to print a bunch. We all seem to think we understand fiat, but then we say things like, well, we need to go back to sound money. Yeah, we do. But as long as fiat's here, you have to play the fiat game. And we're super fortunate that we can also play the sound money game. I have my escape, right? So I think our goal, or the goal of the government, should be to leverage the fiat system as it is, to protect American lives and American prosperity as much as it can, while hedging bets on what I think the future will be, which will be Bitcoin, because we all know that the fiat dollar won't be around forever.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. The Bitcoin time chain is 858823, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. Today's episode is Bitcoin Talk, where I talk with my guest about Bitcoin and whatever else comes up. Today, that guest is Samuel Arms. This conversation is really a sneak peek behind the curtain of the lobbying process in America, and how things actually work and get done in the political world. We get into the intersection of politics and Bitcoin. Samuel shares his experience in lobbying for Bitcoin legislation in Florida and crafting the anti-CBDC bill there, the impact of Donald Trump's speech at Bitcoin 2024, and how it shifted the national conversation around Bitcoin, the influence of Bitcoin in political campaigns moving forward, and a whole lot more. Before we dive in, do me a favor and subscribe to the Bitcoin Podcast wherever you are listening or watching, and check out my sponsor Bitbox in the show notes, or go directly to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker to get 5% off the fully open source, Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. You can also grab links to protect yourself from SIM swap attacks using Ifani and Cloaked Wireless. I am a one-man show, so when you use my partner links, it genuinely helps me keep this show running, and I truly appreciate it. If you'd rather watch this show than listen, head to the show notes for links to watch on YouTube, Rumble, and on Noster via Highlighter. But if you're like me and you prefer to just listen to your podcast while you do something else, I highly recommend you check out Fountain.fm. Not only can you send Bitcoin to your favorite podcasters to give value for value, but you can earn Bitcoin just for listening to this fucking podcast. Finally, if you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, hit me up on social media, through the website bitcoinpodcast.net, or shoot me an email. It's hello@bitcoinpodcast.net. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk with Samuel Arms. Sam, man, good to see you again. It's been, let's see, since Nashville now, bumped into each other backstage, and the rest, as they say, is history. How you doing, man?
Everything's going good, just staying busy. Election is less than 90 days out. We were just on a great podcast today with Gary, who I work with, Gary Cardone. So just staying very busy up until November, and then just, lots to figure out. But I thought Bitcoin Nashville was very good. Seeing Trump there was awesome. Seeing RFK Jr., who's now endorsed Trump there, was awesome. I thought that conference was very well done. And then I just got back from the SALT conference in Wyoming, which is hosted by Scaramucci, who's obviously, on the opposite side of the Trump fence, but still a very, I think, kind of cool, neat, interesting dude to pay attention to. So, yeah, just living the life.
I tuned in for part of the live stream you guys had earlier today. Grant was pretty hilarious. He was getting fired up there. It was great to see. But, Scaramucci is an interesting one. I wouldn't have pegged him to be such a gung-ho Kamala supporter,
But I guess he has some interesting history with Trump as well. So maybe that has tainted the waters a little bit. I don't know. It's interesting to me.
Politics is really simple. A lot of it's more about personal relationships than it is actual policy. And so, Scaramucci got bounced out of the White House and I think has had a vendetta ever since, you know. And so does it make sense? You know, it makes sense if your whole life is run off of relationships as alignment, you know, but that's just how it is sometimes.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And I mean, yeah, I want to get into kind of like the political, let's say, landscape with you leading up to the election and everything. But I want to kind of start with actually what got you and I chatting. We were sitting backstage when Gary was on stage, and Carl and I, my lovely wife, were MCs, you know, and you and I got chatting, and, you know, I was just asking, you know, what you did, and you're like, oh, you know, you heard of the CBDC legislation in Florida, and you talked about how you helped push that through, and I was just like, oh, well, that's fascinating. And so we exchanged info, and I wanted to talk with you about that a little bit, because I think it's a really cool thing to see kind of behind the curtain a little bit of how this shit actually gets done. A lot of times, you know, you see these bills come out and you see the headlines one way or another. You see a little bit of chatter about it, but then you don't actually know like what moved the needle, what got things done behind the scenes. So can you talk about that a little bit? Or maybe it's better if we start out just, who are you? How did you get here today to have your hands in a few different buckets that you do right now, doing quite a lot of different things?
Yeah, I kind of forced my way into the political realm. You know, so my background, really my first professional foray into Bitcoin was I did some research for USS SOCOM out of MacDill Air Force Base. It's United States Special Operations Command on the counter-threat finance and you know, whether Bitcoin was going to be used by ISIS or drug cartels and how they might actually take it down, which was very fascinating. And then I was at the State Department for a little bit, maybe about 6 months. And there I was actually working on like Bitcoin policy at the State Department, and then came out of there, decided I didn't want to go into government work, you know, just not a good cultural fit for me. So I came back. Loved Florida. That's where I'm born and raised. That's where I'm a native. And I didn't want to live in DC, but loved politics, the political process. I come from a very politically minded family where politics was always discussed at the dinner table and around other people. So just kind of like sitting in on that, you know, very easy to catch the political bug. And come 2017, I worked, or 2018, somewhere in there, I worked in the Florida legislature, came out, worked for a lobbying firm, and pitched a lobbying firm on lobbying for Bitcoin, kind of broader Web3 blockchain, whatever the cool term was then, policy, right, to try to sell them on it. And they weren't interested, so I left and started my own lobbying firm and then my own Chamber of Commerce, which was the first state focused Chamber of Commerce for the industry, which was the Florida Blockchain Business Association, which is still running today. And since I started it, we've passed 5, maybe 6 now bills in the legislature. We have another upcoming legislative session here where we're also going to be hopefully pushing more legislation. And I also sit on the board of a giant chamber that kind of runs all the other state associations, and we've worked with all the other partners in DC, like the Blockchain Association, for example, and coordinating policy with them. So like to pass legislation, I just made a video on my YouTube about how to lobby actually. And lobbying is actually very simple. It's about money and it's about relationships, right? And so what I did when I first started was I just was very good at building relationships. It doesn't take much. You just have to be a friendly person, I think. And so I built those relationships. I kept those relationships. I nurtured them over time so that when it was time for me to really strategically think, okay, how do I get started on passing legislation? I knew all the key people in Florida to do so. So I partnered with the right people from the outset, figured out what I had to do to get a bill sponsored, what the rules of lawmaking are, which are different every year in the state of Florida as they are in other states. You know, the House and the Senate might rewrite the rules slightly on how things are passed. And of course, every state's very different. And then you have rules in DC as well, which of course are going to be their own animal. So you figure out the rules, which I don't have a law degree, by the way. You don't need a law degree. A lot of people want you to have a law degree, but you certainly do not need a law degree in any way, shape, or form to understand, shape, or change legislation. So I had lawyers who worked for me, quote unquote, right, who helped me craft all the policy that I wanted crafted. And so I just started passing legislation from there. And then I guess the hallmark of my career was that anti-central bank digital currency bill. That was definitely the most famous bill. You know, at the time DeSantis was running for president, it was a perfect political opportunity, way for him to stand out in the primary, hopefully get more votes. And then it ended up shaping the national conversation, right? Because, Vivek was already anti-CBDC. But once DeSantis became anti-CBDC, that's when Trump's tone really started to change. He's kind of like, ah, shoot, right? Because at the time, DeSantis was kind of believed to be his biggest competitor. So it turned Trump, I think, it started Trump's initial journey into being the pro-Bitcoin president that he is today. And so it just goes to show you how much influence you can wield, you know, at a state level to affect the national conversation, which is something I think that a lot of people underestimate very highly.
I think it's a really good point because, I mean, at the end of the day, like, the states do have power. Like, that is kind of the point of America, is that the states are powerful, that they do operate, you know, independently. Yes, they are, you know, underneath the federal government, but legislation at the state level makes a huge difference. And like, a lot of Bitcoiners out there may be of the opinion that, like, you know, we just got to completely ignore the state, you know, ignore politics, whatever. But there's that old quote, it's like, you may not care about politics, but politics cares about you. And we can certainly see how, you know, look at a state like Texas, where you have the Bitcoin mining industry, which is just booming. And that's because they've got a lot of folks at that state level, a lot of, you know, private business working very hard, but then a lot of lobbying and a lot of folks at that state level who are seeing the benefits of this, but they don't necessarily, they don't go out of their way to look for this stuff. It's like somebody has to shove it in front of them and kind of, I don't want to say beat them over the head with it, but that kind of feels like how it is sometimes. Like, yeah. Is that kind of your experience with it? Like, they're not going to go out of their way to look for this stuff. Somebody has to actually bring it to them wrapped up neat in a bow and say, look, here's what this is. Here's why you should actually care about it. And here's why this is going to matter for kind of your political career.
Yeah. You know, when I first started the association, even to this day, you know, I get Bitcoiners who give me tons of hate for even talking to government. You know, I still have people who are like, yeah, why would you do that? We don't need to do that. But it's a different philosophy. You know, a lot of times, you know, and those are only conversations that you have with individuals. Anytime you're talking to a business owner, that's never the case. As long as you're a business owner, business owners who are normally like producing something, right, get, okay, well, if I'm going to be in America, I kind of have to be involved. And that's why a lot of what I've done is really focused around businesses. Originally, we were trying to take the model of moving a lot of individuals, but because of that kind of philosophy in the community, we changed our course. But, you know, the best example was in last legislative session, there was a bill that was going to be pretty bad for Florida. You know, I kind of termed it our mini bit license, creating a regime that I just thought was terrible. Not a long bill by any means, but certainly a bad bill. Certainly a bad bill. And I walked into this legislator's office with, you know, five or six people, businesses that I had brought up that this bill was going to affect their industry, their companies directly. I sat down, I said, hey, so we just wanted to talk to you about this bill. You know, it's our belief that it's in no way, shape, or form a good bill. And we actually think it's going to kill jobs. And, you know, I didn't even get through my whole pitch. And he cut me right off. And he said, hey, you know, we don't really need to talk about this because I haven't even read the bill. A buddy just told me it was a good bill. That's why I, you know, sponsored it. You know, so you have no worries. Like, I'm not going to pass it this session. You can go talk to my friend who said it was a good idea. And his friend was, of course, a lobbying firm trying to push the bill on behalf of, funny enough, another crypto company. So, which is also very funny how a lot of people don't understand that part of the adoption cycle means that crypto companies and Bitcoin companies might actually themselves trying to pass legislation that creates a moat for themselves. you know, at the cost of your average Bitcoiner, so to speak. So that's also a fun little tidbit for you if you want to go into the political realm, is just seeing, you know, who's playing for what team, really. But yeah, it's about just being there. Had we not even had that conversation, everyone in that room and the legislators would have probably assumed, okay, this bill is fine. We haven't heard anything, right? And, you know, tweeting about it doesn't really help. For a lot of these people, it's best to be there in person. Not saying Twitter is not an effective political tool, but a lot of these conversations will not happen in the public sphere, right? A lot of them are behind closed doors. A politician's never going to say out in public, I never read the bill that I was pushing. You know, they'll never tell you that. And I'll never name the politician, right? Because I just think that would be a stupid idea. But that's really what lobbying comes down to, is lobbying comes down to, you know, lobbying. I mean, the term was created because people would wait outside the chamber lobbies to talk to the politicians about what decisions were being made. So it's about being there in person, having intimate conversations, and then building relationships close to power so that you can have influence. And a lot of people don't want to do that. A lot of people don't have time to do that. That's why a lot of times I'll also argue that as long as you're in a democracy, you know, lobbying is actually very free market because it's just marketing to government, right? You have B2C, B2B, I call it B2G, right? And there's very practical use cases for it. Obviously, I'm biased, right? Because I'm the one doing it all. So whether that's me just justifying my own position and role, but I do truly believe that. So, you know, it's a world in and of itself. You know, and not a lot of people, especially in my industry in the political world, and a lot of people really, you know, don't talk about it too much. You know, a lot of them are behind the scenes. But I made the decision, I think, 2 years ago that I was going to push more in media. And that's actually, you know, when I teamed up with Gary Cardone now. And both of us are pushing more into media because we both kind of saw that same vision where everything we've done in Bitcoin and crypto in our previous careers and now in politics aligns with what we want to do publicly around media. So I'll stop my rant. Hopefully that's given you enough alpha to chew on.
No, absolutely. And, you know, this is always a safe space for rants, not like a bullshit safe space where everyone's feelings are respected, but like a safe space where you can rant freely. I think it's fascinating because, again, I'm somebody who, like, I very much like don't have an interest in, let's say, getting involved in the political process. At the same time, I'm very interested in what's happening because these decisions that happen all the time genuinely affect me. And so it's like, and I think a lot of people are in that boat where it's like, maybe you don't want to get your hands dirty, but some people do want to get their hands dirty and are going to get their hands dirty. And it is helpful to have people that are at least getting their hands dirty for things you care about, right? Like, and ultimately it's like, you're not going to stop lobbying. And I would agree with you that lobbying is essentially like, I mean, that's the market, right? Like if that's, it favors incumbents, as you correctly pointed out, like crypto type companies lobbying to basically create a larger moat. We saw that exact same thing and still see that happening with big tech companies more generally. You look at any of the, you know, Facebook and Google, these companies that will advocate and go in front of Congress and say that, well, you know, maybe we need more, you know, more censorship. We need more control of this. You look at the big AI companies, you know, OpenAI, which is certainly not open, but going out and saying, we need more AI regulation. And it's like, well, why do they do that? Is it because they themselves want to be regulated? No, it's because they want to help draft regulation that can then be used to stifle out small up and coming, you know, competitors who may be able to creep into their market. Like that's the reality of the situation. And so it's like, whether or not you like it, it is the reality. And it's one that, like, you have to be able to navigate and deal with. And I'm kind of curious, you know, obviously, okay, so Donald Trump spoke at Bitcoin 2024. Whatever somebody thinks of Trump, you cannot deny that that was a fucking historic moment. That's a former president, potentially the next president of the United States, who came to a conference for magic internet money. Like, that's pretty wild. That's a pretty big deal. RFK Jr. as well, who's now endorsed Trump, was there. He was there the year before as well with Vivek, both announced at Bitcoin 2023, they'd be accepting political donations in Bitcoin. That's pretty cool. But just like this shifting of the Overton window that we see, where now you've got a national spotlight on a Bitcoin conference, the Bitcoin conference, the biggest one in the world, because the former president is there and speaking about this as, you know, I noticed the tone of his speech, and let me know what you think about this, but it was very much focused on Bitcoin as the industry. It was like he compared it to the steel industry, right?
Yep.
He's talking about this as like a fundamental building block of you know, American industry, because we obviously the steel industry is not what it used to be in America. No hard industries are. Bitcoin has a chance to be, and right now there is a lot of hashing power there. What was your take on just the overall tone of his speech? I mean, I think he still has probably a lot to learn about Bitcoin. You know, that's okay as well. Like, he's only going to learn so much so fast with quite a lot of other things on his plate. But I mean, do you think that conversation moved the needle for a lot of both individuals, but also, you know, for a lot of folks in Washington, potentially, like made them kind of realize, oh, we need to pay attention to this. We can't just ignore it. This is something that is in the national conversation now, and now it won't go away.
Yeah, I mean, it very obviously got Kamala Harris worried, you know, trying to attempt a crypto reset. You saw Russia and China both responding, I think, a week later with different crypto Bitcoin policies around what they're going to do around transactions, right? I think I saw China might be reopening up Bitcoin mining again, right? What Trump says matters, and he's not even president, but he's taken very seriously. And other countries and other individuals kind of recognize that. And now, you know, even if you're someone who thinks Kamala's going to win, well, you know, just game theory with politics, you know, Kamala's now going to have to at least keep her eye out for the industry. You know, now she may not like the industry very much because they're more so supporting her competitor. But it's definitely on their radar now, and it's forcing their hand in certain ways. So I think it definitely, you know, it was a game changer. You know, it's crazy to think, you know, Bitcoin being a presidential talking point, at least for one party, right? It's only on the Republican Party platform. It is not on the Democratic Party's platform. But, you know, a lot of this, I think you could have seen in the tea leaves. Traditionally, Republicans have always been kind of the Bitcoin party. A lot of people would argue against that, and that's fine. They can be wrong. But the red states have always led in Bitcoin policy. It's always been Texas and Florida, as opposed to the heavily blue states like California, New York, and Illinois, which have outright tried terrible Bitcoin policy like the BitLicense. Illinois was trying to pass something that would have effectively banned Bitcoin mining in the state, which I think Elizabeth Warren later put in a bill, actually. And then, you know, California with their mini form of the BitLicense and going after ATMs. So, you know, the Republican Party traditionally, I think, has been the Bitcoin party. And a lot of people just, you know, because Bitcoin's quote unquote independent or libertarian minded, a lot of people just haven't been comfortable mentioning that. And I think a lot of people are still uncomfortable with Donald Trump. Right. And secretly don't want him to be pro Bitcoin because they don't want a reason to vote for him. Right. And I still hear comments like that. But, you know, if you're a single issue voter, which, you know, single issue voters are powerful, but still a very small percentage. And I think of single issue voters, probably Bitcoin and cryptocurrency as a whole are probably a minority in the single voting issue. Like abortion is probably a larger demographic for single issue voters than Bitcoin is. But, you know, it's a competitive election. Only about 5 states matter. And so, you know, in either Wisconsin or Michigan, I think 20,000 votes is all you need, because I think that's what Trump won by originally in 2016. I think Biden then beat him in, I think it was Michigan. It might have been Wisconsin. But I think about 70,000 votes. You know, those are very small numbers, actually. Like we're talking, you know, points of a percent, you know, so getting as many single issue voters behind you as possible, it adds up and it becomes very important. So, yeah, I think it shifted the national conversation. It certainly has helped the Republican Party with donations, especially Trump specifically. You know, a lot of that money has gone to Senate races in Montana and Ohio. And actually, funny enough, in California, where they backed Adam Schiff over another Democratic colleague, I forget her name, Porter. I think her last name was Porter, Congresswoman Porter, who was anti-crypto. She's very in sync with Warren, which is why, by the way, at the crypto town hall Harris did, you know, Adam Schiff was there. So that was no surprise to see, because crypto, I think, helped him win his election, his primary. So I think, yeah, crypto now has money. Bitcoin now has money. It has the right people willing to put that money to use. And I think now it has votes. I don't know how impactful those single issue voters will be. Like if they're in Texas and Florida, maybe that affects congressional districts, but I'm not sure that's going to affect, you know, the presidential election. But there's a lot of Bitcoin people in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, then they'll really become powerful.
Whoever you happen to be voting or not voting for this November, it's key to remember that the most important vote you can make is with your money, by saving the value of your time and energy in the hardest money ever discovered, Bitcoin. But to really make that vote count, you need to keep that Bitcoin safe for the long haul. So go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker for 5% off the fully open source, Bitcoin-only BitBox O2 hardware wallet. Then get your Bitcoin off the exchange and into your own self-custody. Why are you waiting? The BitBox team is honestly awesome. I'm really proud to have them as a sponsor. They build easy-to-use, secure, open-source solutions to keep your Bitcoin safe. And not only is the Bitcoin in your BitBox safe from government confiscation, but BitBox is one of the only two wallets to actually address the dark Skippy vulnerability, which I talk about on my recent episode with Staticus of BitBox. Plus, and I cannot emphasize this enough, the BitBox O2 is truly easy as hell to use, whether you are brand new to Bitcoin and it's your very first hardware wallet, or you are a well-seasoned psychopath and you have more than you'd like to admit. It is Bitcoin only. And again, it is fully open source. You can head to their GitHub and verify for yourself. There is no need to trust me or to trust BitBox. When you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker, not only do you get 5% off, but you also help support this fucking podcast. So thank you.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny because Elizabeth Warren very much like took it upon herself to essentially be the voice of this anti-crypto army that she, you know, is building there. And I think it's just, she basically filled a vacuum and nobody was there to call her on it. And you've now seen the results of that, is that the Democrats are seen as the anti-crypto, anti-Bitcoin party, because that's literally what Elizabeth Warren said. And the Republicans not so. Like, it was just a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It seems like Elizabeth Warren miscalculated and thought that somehow she was going to win a lot of people over to her agenda with this whole, her anti-Bitcoin, anti-crypto crusade. That very obviously has not worked. Like, it's not bringing anyone new into her coalition. It is just alienating a huge portion of potential voters who also have their purchasing power. If they're, you know, if they're saving in Bitcoin, their purchasing power is growing every single year. They're becoming an economically significant coalition. And I think that it's like the Democrats had a lot of chances to kind of disavow Warren over these years and just really didn't, you know? And I think it's going to come back to bite him, and maybe not in this election. Like, I mean, you know, being honest, if I was like, when RFK was still in the race, probably was going to vote for RFK, just because I find the duopoly of American politics not productive for the people. Now that RFK has jumped behind Trump, it doesn't really, the endorsement isn't what does it. It's just like, if I'm actually trying to weigh up the benefits, it's like, well, I know I'm not going to vote for Kamala Harris. Like, I just know that. Like, it wouldn't matter who she was running against. I just, dear Lord, I just don't think I could bring myself to it. And, you know, maybe I'll vote for Donald Trump. Maybe I won't vote. Maybe my vote doesn't actually matter that much. But regardless, I'm happy to see the political conversation shifting away from just endless congressional hearings run by Elizabeth Warren, where all she does is just spread lies and anti-Bitcoin propaganda without really having anyone call her on it, and having the big bankers in there who just basically parrot everything she says and say, yep, that's exactly right. We should have more regulation. It's like when the bankers are calling for more oversight, when in fact they're responsible for the majority of the money laundering that happens in this world, it's just kind of, oh, painfully ironic. I don't know.
Yeah, I think politics is very easy. I think people overcomplicate it. I was never an RFK supporter. You know, I think he's a cool guy. I'm glad he was so pro-Bitcoin. But I don't need my president to understand what multi-sig is. Like, for me, that's pretty useless. It's cool. It's cool. And, you know, when politicians kind of cater to those certain crowds, to me, it's a sign of desperation more than anything. You know, RFK was forced out of the Democratic Party. They moved the primary from New Hampshire to South Carolina because they knew he could win New Hampshire. So I really enjoyed kind of what his campaign strategy was. I'm excited to see him backing Trump. I saw Tulsi's now backing Trump. I think that tells you a lot. You know, and people saw this on a Twitter thread I thought was a really good statement. People are policies. So the people who endorse you, the people who you bring on your team, are a representation of the policies that you will pass, regardless of what you say. And so as long as Vivek's close to Trump, like, I'm fine. Like, I don't care if Trump knows anything about Bitcoin. He just needs to say the right things. He needs to keep the right advisors. Awesome. It really is that simple. RFK, I mean, the biggest bragging point was, man, RFK meets so many check marks on the Bitcoin sphere. Well, congrats, he's now an advisor to Trump, right? So that makes it even easier if you're a single issue voter. You know, Elizabeth Warren, people are so funny. And I've said that, I mean, this is pretty well known now, but, you know, she became so powerful because in the 2020 Democratic primary, it was her, Bernie, and Biden. And if Elizabeth Warren had dropped out, Bernie would have won the primary. So she stayed in to take votes away from Bernie. She took about three states away from him, which allowed Joe Biden to clinch the nomination. So, which is really what the primary process is about. Primary political primaries are about negotiating power, right? It's not just about, oh, who comes in second and third. It's like, okay, how can I use my second and third place as leverage? That's what Vivek did. Vivek did it very, very well. He used the Republican primary to get closer to Donald Trump, which was just fantastic strategically. But when Elizabeth Warren made that decision and stayed in to ruin Bernie Sanders' chances, you know, so Biden now owes her favors. I heard about a third of the White House staff came from Warren's office or from picks by Elizabeth Warren. So that told me right there, okay, when Biden was still the nominee, if Biden won again, the crypto positions were going to be the same. A lot of the advisors of Biden on crypto and Bitcoin policy are anti the industry. It's looking like Kamala might be picking some of those same people, regardless of what she says. And, you know, Kamala herself has still yet to really say anything. You know, so the crypto town hall where you have a lot of different Democratic people, they were actually, I listened to the whole thing, they were actually trashing Biden, which I found very interesting. Trying to separate the two, even though I don't believe you can, but the media has done a very good job of separating Kamala and Biden, and some crypto people have fallen in line with that. But I view them as the same, and a lot of those staffers will be the same. A lot of the internal people will be the same. And until Kamala comes out and says exactly what Trump has said, which is very easy, for her it would probably be a 5 to 10 minute video. I don't really believe any claims that, you know, there's a Democratic reset or that there's going to be any pro-crypto policy out of her tenure. You know, now, you know, Chuck Schumer is apparently pro-crypto, but the Senate might be flipping Republican, right? And so you might have the most powerful Democratic position who's pro-crypto not even be in power anymore. You know, and who knows what will happen in the House. So, you know, to me, it's all just, it's very simple. And then if you believe in voting in your interests, just like you believe in the market, which is all about, you know, pursuing your interests, you know, you can complain about the duopoly, but I think it's very simple. You know, it's kind of, I always laugh, it's kind of like the gun debate. okay, well, do you want the pro-gun or anti-gun party? Right, you can hate everything else, but if guns is a big thing for you, you know, not voting is not going to help you if the anti-gun people win and you're pro-gun, or vice versa. Right, you can apply that to being pro-life or pro-abortion. So, I think it's very simple. So I think, you know, if you're a Bitcoiner, Trump's a very obvious pick at this point. I thought he was the obvious pick before he even went on stage in Nashville. But I think now, like, if you're debating, it's very obvious a lot of these people aren't really single issue voters, which is fine, by the way. It's perfectly okay. But a lot of them, you know, obviously Bitcoin isn't their number one factor. It's a lot of other things as well. But, you know, that's people, right? And part of the political process is just learning and understanding what your average person's voter psychology is, and then just maneuvering around that or with it, and using that to kind of feed some of your decisions.
Yeah, I mean, the reality of the situation is that, like, I truly believe, like, everything is good for Bitcoin. I truly don't understand why Kamala would not just come out, and as you said, it would be very easy for her to just come out and say, just take what Trump said verbatim, you know, switch it up a little, add some laughs in the middle. You know she will anyway.
Yeah.
Why not? Why would she hold back from that? I mean, presumably she's not making the decisions about what her own policy is. That's the only reason I could think, because it seems like a no-brainer if you, A, want to bring more potential voters over to your side that are single issue voters, even if it's a small coalition of voters, it can still be meaningful. But B, if you want to be able to increase your fundraising, like, that is what this machine runs off of, right? Why would you not just say, look, I mean, like, that's the beauty of Bitcoin. Whether you're looking at it from a conservative or a progressive lens, it falls within that lens. Like, it is both conservative and progressive. It is progressive in the sense that it completely annihilates existing power structures and builds a new system. It is conservative in the sense that it is sound money, that it is a return to actual sound money and potentially a sounder basis of what we can build everything else on top of, which is a better monetary system. And so it's like, regardless of which side you're coming from, you should be able to find great reasons to be pro-Bitcoin. The reasons for being anti-Bitcoin are usually a little bit more nefarious. And so it's like, if you're not being vocally pro Bitcoin, it's like, well, then you're not pro your citizens. You're not aiming to advance the best interests of your citizens. You're not pro freedom. And that just seems like a really, I have to imagine she's just either has no idea what's going on and hasn't even been made aware of this, which could very much be the case. Or she has people who are just very actively telling her, and I don't know what kind of justifications they're giving, but that no, you should just, we'll just give them a little bit of lip service, we'll do a little town hall, and that'll be enough. That'll be enough to convince the people we need to convince, and we won't convince anyone else anyway, so let's just maintain course, let's not piss off the bankers, let's just keep doing what we're doing. I don't know, it seems insane to me. She has such a huge opportunity to come out and be pro-Bitcoin. Why not take it?
The tough part for Kamala is she's late. So Bitcoiners have already given a lot of their money to, for example, the Republican senator running in Montana against John Tester, and then against Sherrod Brown in Ohio. So a lot of money has already been poured into Republican campaigns. Probably a majority amount has gone into Republican campaigns. And then because Trump has come out first, it makes Kamala look politically weak if she capitulates on any of her stances. That's one of the reasons why Biden, before he stepped down, was trying to inch around, like, what does he do? Does he veto this bill that's good for crypto or not, right? If he vetoes it, he's viewed as an enemy. But if he doesn't veto it, it shows that we have power over him, and that's not something that they want to admit, right? So it becomes a lot of political power posturing. So if I was in Kamala's camp, it's definitely a tight spot. But what's easy for Kamala is there's so many Democrats in crypto. You know, a lot of people in Bitcoin who own Bitcoin businesses, and of course, a lot of Bitcoin media, like any media, is very Democratic. And so a lot of them have been itching for her to say anything pro-Bitcoin just so that they could push the narrative that she is. You know, so it really wouldn't be hard. She doesn't have to give much. I think her strategy is really just stay out of the limelight. She's trying to stay off camera. She hasn't really announced too many policy positions besides the price controls, which once again, if you're a Bitcoiner, it's just funny to me, like how you justify voting for someone who's for price controls and then thinks they're pro Bitcoin is, you know, the cognitive dissonance there, I think, is a little funny. But even still,
straight up socialism. Like, I mean, yeah. It's literally socialism.
But it doesn't matter because Bitcoiners, if they're Democrats, will vote for her anyway, right? Because it's about fitting, which everyone does this, right? I'm not just roasting Democrats, but more often than not, we fit something into our own narrative, right? And so it's more about Kamala, just give me something to fit into my Democratic narrative so I can brag about how you are actually pro Bitcoin, as opposed to is she actually pro Bitcoin or not? The answer is she's not. The answer is she probably won't be. But if you're a Democrat and you hate Donald Trump, but you love Bitcoin and you're in the Bitcoin space, you know, you're like, man, this kind of sucks. I hate Trump, but I like Bitcoin. What do I do? You know, more often than not, I think a lot of them will still vote for Kamala. I don't think they're actual single issue voters. I think they'll fall in line with the rest of their party, majority of them. And for the people who were going to vote for RFK, you know, those are more independent minded, kind of like to your point, those types of people most likely just wouldn't vote anyway. So the big question is how many of them are going to actually fall on the bandwagon and vote for Trump. And if a lot of them do, you know, if probably if 80% of RFK supporters were to vote for Trump, I think he very easily wins the election. But if it's 50-50 split, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I would be very surprised to see folks who are big fans of RFK go and vote for a Democratic ticket, given how much RFK just roasted the entire Democratic apparatus. Like he basically just, you know, obliterated them essentially in his last few addresses. I would be very, like, if someone is a real diehard, you know, like Bobby fan, I find it difficult to believe that they would go and vote for Kamala, but you know, you never know. People are funny. And maybe they, you know, I think a lot of people hold out hope for what their preferred political team can be versus the reality of what it is. And, you know, the other reality is, like, the one thing that we know, whether Trump or Kamala is elected, is that there's going to be massive, massive money printing either way. Like, I don't see either one of them. That's something I certainly haven't heard Kamala talk about. I mean, she's talking about fucking socialist price controls, which literally have never worked throughout all of history. And, like, find me an example of price controls not leading to shortages and not leading to complete breakdown, and I'll give you 15 sats. But on Trump's side, like, I have not heard anything from him about, you know what, I'm going to work on having a sounder money. Like, yeah, he briefly talked about, we're going to hold on to the Bitcoin that we have, that, like, half of it is actually Bitfinex's Bitcoin. So that's like a whole legal battle, but who knows? But I it would be nice to hear something from Trump about, hey, we actually need to get back to sounder money. We need to stop inflating our currency so much. We need to maybe put some better checks in place to rein in our runaway banking sector and not give them the backstop that we always give them, which is the Fed bailout. Like, because that just does not, that prevents anything from ever meaningfully changing when the banks know that even if they fuck up, they're always going to get bailed out at the taxpayer's expense. Or if the, you know, it's not technically at the taxpayer's expense, it's ultimately still at their expense because the taxpayer suffers because the value of their dollar is worth less and less and less. So I would be interested to see if his messaging, if some of the Bitcoiners around him, because I think Vivek has talked about this a little bit more. Certainly a lot of the Bitcoiners who are in his ear or seem to be in his ear, in his campaign's ear, talk about this a lot. So I'd be interested to see if he actually says anything about that, because under his last administration, it was like, it was COVID, but we had historic money printing, like, and that seems to be, whether it's red or it's blue, the Fed ends up printing money, like, and more than they did the previous administration. Like, that's the one thing that has bipartisan support, it seems. Well, that and war, but that's a different story.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of fall off the Bitcoin train about caring about money printing. It's my belief that like we're on the train of money printing, talking about money printing and fiscal responsibility. Like if you're a politician, talking about fiscal responsibility of nations useful for people who believe in fiscal conservatism. But realistically, that's never going to happen. We all know that money printing is like a drug, and no one's going to commit political suicide by actually cutting government spending and then ruining the economy for a, 2 year period just to have the next 3, 4 years, and then once you're unelected, the next president benefit from, right, the measures that you took further. And that's what happens a lot of, if you look at some states, like there's a lot of examples of states that had hugely fiscally irresponsible governors. A new governor comes in, does what needs to be done, gets unelected in his, second term. And then the new guy comes in, then all the benefits of the previous guy, come into fruition from that like austerity, so to speak. But the guy who did it, did all the hard decisions, gets none of the credit, right? So it's not politically astute to do. It's not, I don't think it makes even, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me in a lot of ways. Like one of the places the Bitcoin community definitely failed was like a lot of Bitcoiners think Donald Trump was anti-Bitcoin in his first term, which I actually disagree with. I put that on us for being bad at marketing. The US dollar, whether you like it or not, is the most important geopolitical tool known to man, and is part of the reason why we keep our livelihood here in America, our high standard of living, even though that is declining. And so to go to a president and say, well, I want to take out, your number one tool geopolitically, no president's going to be for that, right? And I would actually agree with that president. The US dollar, unfortunately, which is in the hands of a lot of bad people, still gives us a lot of security and leverage, even though it's still being improperly managed. So it's an interesting political question. Like I don't care for Trump to talk about sound money. I know he's going to print. I'm expecting him to print a bunch. To me, that's not antithetical to Bitcoin, actually. I think fiat's going to do what fiat's going to do. I think your fiat strategy should be different than your Bitcoin strategy. I mean, that's the fun part. Like we all seem to think we understand fiat, but then we say things like, well, we need to go back to sound money. Yeah, we do. But as long as fiat's here, you have to play the fiat game. And we're super fortunate that we can also play the sound money game. I have my escape, right? So I think our goal, or the goal of the government, should be to leverage the fiat system as it is, to protect American lives and American prosperity as much as it can, while hedging bets on what I think the future will be, which will be Bitcoin, because we all know that the fiat dollar won't be around forever. I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. I've made that realization about maybe 5 years ago, around like really doing research on the euro dollar and what the euro dollar is, which still baffles my mind. And that'll also change your perspective on inflation as well. What really causes inflation? It can be money printing, but money printing, in my opinion, is not always linked to inflation. Like I think a lot of our COVID inflation had nothing to do with the money printing and everything to do with energy prices and supply chain shock, right? Which is even more interesting when you look at the Biden administration, inflation really getting bad, and tying that to some of their proposals around energy, by the way, which is something not a lot of people talk about. So, I don't, I Trump for me, it's already said and done. He said everything I need him to say. I'll leave the sound money conversations for people like us to have, right? Because I think he's going to do whatever he needs to do to get elected. That's what I care about. I care about him winning. And if talking about sound money starts to like lose some votes, I'm more than happy for him to just stay quiet on it.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the honesty and the realism. Again, I'm in agreement with you that I do not think the fiat dollar is going away anytime soon. I also think that if and when the fiat dollar does go away, fully collapse, well, that's going to be the last fiat currency to collapse. Like, if the dollar is collapsing, that means that every other fiat currency has likely collapsed as well, maybe with a couple of exceptions. But the reality is that the dollar is still, you know, the king of the castle. Like, and yeah, there's a lot of people at the top who use that dollar as a weapon, much to the detriment of folks all over the world. But the reality is that those other currencies are going to die off long before the dollar does. And, you know, ultimately it's like, yeah, you're right that there is going to be a massive print, whether Trump or Kamala is elected. Like, the printer will go on. Like, we will inflate, because we're $35.2 trillion in debt. There's literally, the interest expense in that debt is bigger than our military budget. There is literally no way for them to remain solvent unless they massively debase the currency. It's literally the only way. That, or a complete reset by having a massive scale hot war. Like, those are basically the two ways that you end up resetting the system. There's no other ways. They have, those are the two doors. And I, you know, maybe it's a, you know, por que no los dos, just a little bit of both, who knows. But ultimately, and this sounds callous to say, but as a Bitcoin holder, all of that is good for Bitcoin. Like, that is very good for Bitcoin. If we're measuring Bitcoin in terms of the fiat price, which most people still are. At the same time, you know, like, it's the reality. Like, it's going to pump a lot of bags, and you can feel dirty for saying it, but it is the truth. And again, I think that for Bitcoiners, it's like, oh, there is the reality of the world that we live in, and there's very much a inspiring and hopeful future that I think people are building to in parallel, and that I very much try to support and want to see. At the same time, we become able to better influence the existing system from the outside, influence from our parallel system, when our purchasing power in the existing system increases massively. When that happens, you can affect more change from the outside in, because the system's not going to change itself from the inside out. The fiat system is what it is. It's not going to fix itself from the inside. It needs to be forced to change from the outside. And when you talk about long-term prosperity, that is the only thing that is going to do that, is energy security, which Bitcoin helps to drive. Like, we see this. We see Texas is honestly an amazing proving ground for this. Stability and security. And then also just general freedom to transact outside this existing system is something that Bitcoiners should not take for granted. That is really amazing that we have that. And you see with all the, with Pavel Durov, with the Telegram CEO, who's just been, you know, tossed in jail by the French and slapped with a bunch of charges. Like, the censorship industrial complex is going to get worse. And if they can censor your money, like with a CBDC, for example, they will. And, you know, I'm curious how you see a slight gear shift here, but just going into this next election, do you think we start to see the censorship train just heat up even more? Like, I saw the Rumble founder is now, they're shut off in France right now. Rumble is.
Are they really?
I just saw this, like, a couple tweets about it right before we got on. Didn't get a chance to independently verify, but it appears that they're shut down in France. I know that the Rumble CEO was leaving Europe because he's not feeling too comfortable there. Can't blame him. But I don't know. I feel like the whole censorship's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. We just saw Zuckerberg admitting that the Biden-Harris administration was asking them to censor COVID stuff. Like, we all knew this was happening, but now it's just like, it's fully admitted. Like, it's in the congressional record now. How do you see this shaking out around election time? Like, things going to get very, very strange? Are we going to start seeing major platform censorship? What's your take?
I mean, if it's any worse than in the last election, right? I mean, last election, you have to remember Dorsey's Twitter, you know, censored tons of people, including at the time a sitting president. Facebook did the same. Google did the same. And all those players are still doing the same thing. We had, you know, a worldwide pandemic, which can still get you banned on certain platforms for talking about. You know, so censorship, like, we're lucky in America that we have the First Amendment, although, you know, that is like a tertiary shield. But, you know, other countries don't have that. We do. And so that gives us a standing basis to fight some of these fights. And we're very fortunate that someone like Elon Musk bought Twitter. We're even in an odd irony fortunate that, you know, TikTok is a foreign company, right? Which censors us on a foreign censorship scale instead of the American censorship scale, right? So it's like different things are censored, so you can kind of play cat and mouse, right? And talk about different things on different platforms, which is a ridiculous spot to be in as an American, but that is the spot that we're in. So, you know, I think if Kamala wins, things will definitely get worse on the censorship side, whether that's from the government or from the quote-unquote free market of Google and Facebook, just coordinating and deciding what speech is allowed and what's not. I think Elon's going to be in a lot of trouble if Kamala wins as well. I think he's, after Trump, public enemy number two. And if I were him, I would definitely be scared of going out of the country. If I were him, I'd be scared of going out of Texas, right? So, you know, I do think it's going to get ramped up. I don't know how that plays out, right? I think you're also still going to see the typical canceling of people and, you know, debanking and all that fun, exciting stuff that we see here and there. It's probably a little calm right now because of the administration in power and it being an election year. But depending on who wins, I think it could really ramp up. And hopefully lawyers that are pro First Amendment are ready for that here in the U.S. But those are long battles. You know, Zuckerberg just admitted that he was the bad guy. He probably still is the bad guy. Who knows what else he's censoring and working on, right? Like, I have no doubt in my mind that everyone knew he was going to make this announcement 6 months ago to a year ago, and they've been planning for this and how they're going to shape it. You know, so what Zuckerberg does from here, I'm not sure, but I guarantee you it's not him saying, you know, I'm tired of this government, I'm going to speak out. That's not it. Anyone who thinks it is, I think, is a little ridiculous. You know, so I think it's going to ramp. I think censorship is going to ramp up and become, if it's not already, the next big political fight. How that plays out policy-wise is going to be very interesting. It's going to really rack a lot of braids because, you know, I hear arguments about government shouldn't be involved in what private citizens do, but then your biggest private citizens and platforms are Google, Facebook, right, who are doing a majority of the censorship, right? So I don't think being censored by a giant corporation is any better than being censored by the government, for example, especially when those giant corporations control levers of power to then get you debanked. So, you know, I think it's going to ramp up. I think what's happening with the owner of Telegram or the founder of Telegram is a canary in the coal mine. And we'll just have to see who they go after next. But, you know, it's not looking good in the sense that I think they're going to double down and start going after some other people as well. But we'll wait to see. A lot of the times it's like reading tea leaves, like the French government doing this. I don't believe it's on their own. Right, this was probably coordinated by the EU, and then they kind of pick, okay, who wants to handle this, right? And I know the US is probably involved as well. You know, so what the next European country is going to do, like England's already persecuting you for retweeting, right? I don't see how it gets much worse than that at all. So very interested for anyone who supports those types of policies. But yeah, I think... we are very lucky as Americans to have the First Amendment, and we often forget that that is a uniquely American thing, along with the Second Amendment, that other countries don't have the luxury of getting. And we're seeing that play out in real time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it's to give Jack Dorsey a little credit, and I think this is not to excuse the actions of any owners or CEOs, controllers of companies, but they're put in an impossible position, which is a function of their position itself, which is they are the throat to choke, right? They are the head to cut off. So when the government comes to you and says, you need to censor this,
And when you're a publicly traded company, well, it's a threat, right? It's not even an implicit threat. It's a very explicit threat that's censor this or else. We're going to make your life hell. We're going to ruin your company. Like, maybe that part's a little bit more implicit. But what I do appreciate about Dorsey is that he has now taken a lot of his money and invested it in open source protocols, in things like Nostr, building a parallel system for free and open communication. Because even Twitter has undoubtedly or X now. Like, I think that a lot of the change that Elon has made has been good. I think it's also good that he's, for instance, paying content creators with advertising dollars. I think that's a really cool thing to do. It incentivizes some different sorts of behavior, but I think it's a net benefit that people can now earn some money from the impressions that they get versus just fully being the product. But at the same time, Elon is still the head to cut off. He's still the throat to choke. Even if we assume he has all the best intentions, not to censor, not to deplatform, not to ban people, he's still that figurehead. He's still the one that they can come after. And that's why, it's like the beauty of Satoshi Nakamoto is that he disappeared, right? Because if he hadn't disappeared, we wouldn't be having the same conversation about Bitcoin here today. This is the beauty of something like Nostr, where once the open source code is out there, anyone can use this, anyone can run this. And I think I don't think it's going to play a huge role in this current election cycle, but I just know, I'm not sure if you're on Nostr yet. If not, I'll send you some stuff. I'd be happy to help you get set up because I think you'd dig it. But we've seen a pretty large influx in users, relatively speaking, over just the last couple of days since this Pavel Durov arrest. Because each one of these little things, when it comes to censorship, it makes a few more people wake up a little bit. And they may not actually give a shit about censorship resistance because they think, well, I'm never going to be censored. But enough of these things happen and people start to realize, maybe I should try out this other thing just in case. Just in case, because I don't know where things are going to go. And I think a lot of people feel a lot of uncertainty right now in general about what is the world or my nation going to look like in the next 5 to 10 years? Like, is it going to be, better? Is it going to be worse? I don't think anybody is really of the opinion like, well, it's all going to stay exactly the same. You can feel there's this energy right now where everybody thinks something's coming. Maybe it's good. Maybe it's bad. I don't know. Maybe that's just me projecting, which is also certainly possible. But it seems like these next few years, like a lot of people have made the argument, we're in that fourth turning, right? We're in the midst of it. This is the time where big things change, and they change really, really fast. And if you're not paying attention, you're going to be in rough shape. So it's good to wake up if you're not already.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely more of an Elon fan than I am a Dorsey fan. Still not too big of a Dorsey fan, but I do have an appreciation for anyone who will put money to a good cause, for sure. I do think we are at one of those pivotal moments. Certainly the energy seems that way. I hear a lot of people talk about the fourth turning, and I've read the book. Very, very good book. Fun book. One of those books where it's like every page you're kind of like, I have to, when I read, like, okay, let me Google this event, let me Wikipedia that event, because I have no idea what he's referring to. And then it takes me forever to get through a chapter, because then I get lost on another research tangent. But yeah, I think reality in life always seeks equilibrium. And I think Bitcoin tipped that equilibrium to the side of freedom. And so the only response to that is more authoritarianism, which will then tip it into, more freedom. I think that's always a cat and mouse game. Who said it? Maybe it was Dostoevsky. Maybe it was somebody else. And I'm totally going to misquote. But I think the saying was, the freest man is one step away from tyranny, right? And I do think that's true. And I think we realize what freedom truly is when you can see what tyranny is. And sometimes it's a unfortunate and not so fun, but needed lesson. That's just called the circle of life and human nature, right? Much like books like The Fourth Turning, I think, hint at or even preach. So I think we're definitely in one of those moments where, you know, we've had the World Wide Web, which has given us more freedom of expression than we've ever had. It's also allowed us to be tracked like we've never been tracked before. You know, a lot of people think that kings in ancient England were terrible dictators, but a king in ancient England couldn't figure out what you were saying in your house 24/7. You know, you didn't get Amazon ads because of what you Googled, right? So I think the tyranny that we have now is potentially far worse, but we have even more channels and avenues to, you know, escape that kind of tyranny and promote freedom. So, you know, technology just kind of ups the stakes of that freedom and tyranny game. And I think that's what we're going to see. You know, we'll see what happens to the owner and founder of Telegram, right? You know, he's not a French citizen to my knowledge, you know, but he's going to be prosecuted like he's some Russian criminal, you know, committing terrorist activity. Are we as a country going to stand up for him, right? Is anyone going to call them out? Does it matter? Is Putin going to call him out, right? Because the irony is Putin asked for him to ask for the owner to give them all access to Telegram, and supposedly he said no and then fled Russia. It's too bad he fled Russia to the West and then found out, hey, this is actually the worst option, as we're seeing. So at least for him specifically. Yeah, so, you know, the only thing to do is live through it and be prepared. You know, big fan of parallel economies, parallel media, parallel societies. I think that's what happens in a time of somewhat decay, right? You know, you just build for the next step in the future. That's what, you know, Isaac Asimov was all about. And I think that's true. And I think the best golden ages come from those types of cycles. So, you know, I'm very optimistic, actually, regardless of all of this, even if Kamala wins, for example, still very optimistic about the future and the trends that I'm seeing. And it's not just because I'm young, although that's certainly my job. But I do think the trend errs in the favor of freedom. And so I'm still very bullish and excited about the future, regardless of what role Bitcoin even has in it.
No, I mean, amen to that. And I think, you know, I want to be conscious of your time here too. But one thing I did want to touch on with you was just because you mentioned at the end, just kind of this changing media landscape, because I know this is something that you are very much tuned into, both from the political process and then through the other work that you're doing. But, you know, we're at the point right now where podcasts, not this podcast, but say someone like Joe Rogan, absolutely dwarfs the amount of viewership, listenership that, like, all the whatever, I don't even know if people still call them cable news, you know, but legacy news channels do, like, combined, like all of them combined don't even touch his viewership. And he's one guy, and there's many, you know, he's the biggest, but there's many others who get similar numbers on long form conversations. Like, in a time where basically everybody is a little bit ADD and has a super short attention span, somehow people still tune in for an hour and a half, 2.5 hours to listen to a couple of people talk, and they tune in the millions. Meanwhile, you know, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, they're lucky if they get 500,000 during prime time, which is insane. How do you see this evolving? Like, I mean, I think probably during Obama's election was probably the first real maybe social media election through his use of Facebook, and, you know, pulled that off very well, right? Credit where credit is due. Obviously, Twitter has now X, but Twitter before had played a huge role in other elections. How do you see this shaking out during this election cycle? Because, you know, you start to get the feeling that it's like everybody still gets, the algorithm still silos people into their echo chambers. So it's like, yeah, in your left, you know, in your blue echo chamber, everybody is saying how amazing Kamala is and how there's all this fake news from the Republicans and da-da-da. And in your red echo chamber, it's the exact opposite. Everybody's spreading lies about Trump, you know, but it's all just people agreeing with each other. And the algorithm sometimes throws people together confrontationally and you see some sparks fly, but does that ever really move the needle in terms of the average person? Maybe it's the average person isn't the one commenting. They're just the one watching all this unfold and there is some needle moving, but how do you see the media landscape really? Do you think it's, is it different during this election cycle or is it more of the same? We're not quite at a phase shift yet.
It's a good question. You know, they say Obama was the first social media president. Trump was the first meme president. And I think that's true. I think Netflix is a very good example. Like Netflix was the cable killer. And then you had Hulu and you have Amazon Prime and you have HBO. But now there's so many media services that now they're starting to offer live 24-hour TV on some of these media streaming services. Some of them are bundling, right? And hey, you can bundle Netflix and HBO going back to the cable model. So I think it's the natural process of consolidation and then decentralization to then consolidation again. With decentralized media, one thing Gary will always say is how amazing it is. Like anyone can pick up a $500 camera or really now your iPhone, if you have an iPhone, and even some of these Android cameras, get one of those and just start talking. Right? It's very easy and it's very powerful. And so, you know, if you look at the recent, you know, assassination attempt on Trump, how much of what we've seen was recorded via phone and we're able to independently piece together a story based on footage that people are analyzing from phones, right? And that comes with the flip side is that, okay, well, you know, we don't need a surveillance state because we're all surveilling each other all the time, right? And that goes back to the, you know, consolidation and decentralization, but it's the same as freedom and tyranny, is it's always progressing in both directions simultaneously, right? Technology can be used for good as much as it can be used for evil. So I think this election cycle, the most important media avenues are TikTok and Twitter. You know, those are certainly the most diverse and knowledge-rich forms of media. And people laugh when I say that about TikTok. But TikTok's algorithm, you know, focuses on promoting content, not the creator. And so you will see very small accounts have videos go viral because of a video that just popped off. It's a very good news source if you're looking at it for news. But on the flip side of that, as easy as it is to have a TikTok account or even a Twitter account, well, what's happening? We're becoming slaves to an algorithm, right? And so now are we reconsolidating our independent media? Like, what is the point of having a camera if the algorithm says, hey, sorry, you're not a good fit? So you can post into the ether, which is what I love about Twitter, is finding those random accounts that have been posting for 3 years and still have 10 followers, but still have the dedication to post. So shout out to those guys. They're often some of the funniest Twitter accounts. But, you know, are algorithms going to start ruling everything? You know, I talk about, I made a video about Spotify algorithms, and it's very like subtle and nuanced, but you know, when I shuffle my Spotify playlist or my Apple Music playlist, it'll sometimes randomly select songs to, you know, put in my playlist to see if I like them. And music's a very powerful psychological tool. How do I know someone's not paying for that shuffle song bump? Like, is an artist or a media company paying Spotify behind closed doors saying, hey, you know, I want this song shuffled into this type of playlist. Will you promote it? You know, it's just kind of like books. Every time you see a New York Times bestseller, well, it's a New York Times bestseller because the publisher bought the first 500,000 books, which are then given out for signing out at conferences and stuff like that, or giving out books for free. And then it's a New York Times bestseller, which is what makes people then buy the book. Also a great campaign finance technique. That's why every politician writes a book, because you can skirt campaign finance laws. So, you know, media, we're seeing the power structures change a little bit. CNN's dying. Fox News is dying. Tucker now has, you know, one of the best media channels out there. Joe Rogan, Patrick Bet-David, some of these independent creators. And then, you know, quote unquote, micro influencers have incredible political sway, which is awesome. But if they get banned or the algorithm doesn't like them, that becomes a problem, right? And we have yet to see, like a good example is, again, TikTok, the owners of TikTok are not necessarily the greatest people, but you know, we saw when TikTok was potentially going to be banned and forced and sold, who was going to buy it? It was going to be people who are very closely associated with the establishment media as it is today, right? So who's to say that independent media companies don't start getting bought up? As much as you like Joe Rogan, he too has limits. He still has a contract deal with Spotify. You know, he says he'll never have Trump on. I think that is not necessarily his choice completely. You know, just look at, if you look at some, it's very, very subtle, but if you look at some of the people he's had on, it's very easy to notice who he's had back on and who he has not. And so even Joe Rogan, as much as I really like Joe Rogan, I think he's still bound by a contract, right? If Spotify decides one day, hey, you're gone, it'll hurt Spotify, but they'll survive. What does Joe Rogan do? I don't know what Joe Rogan does. CNN's not going to pick him up. He's not going to go to Fox. You know, I guess he has to restart on Twitter or something. But, you know, media is still complex and complicated. But I do think the current power structure has no idea what to do with everyone posting on everything all the time. And I think algorithms can kind of help them handle that. But, you know, your average American, your average consumer is very funny and very clever. You know, I've never heard the term unalive so much. Because if I say the other word that unaliving means, you get banned or you get shadow banned or the algorithm doesn't like you. But unalive is still acceptable. You know, not walking anymore. You like, there's so many fun ways to get around some of these algo codes. And yeah, sometimes you get caught and other times you don't. But, you know, I think the key in media is really to stay innovative. You have to be having fun. And that's what I think makes people able to survive the media landscape is they're having fun. And you see that in some of the biggest YouTube channels like Mr. Beast, who is yet to go political, but I think one day will, even subtly. So, yeah, I think this election, I think TikTok and Twitter are going to be the biggest factors. You know, TikTok, scroll through your TikTok if you have one. I see debates, live debates going on constantly. I host some of them myself, where you'll have in the background, I'm voting for Trump, tell me why you hate him. And you'll have 300-400 people watching. You know, so I think TikTok's the main spot for political news, and I think Twitter is the main spot for political news. Everything else is kind of out in the dustbin, unless you're into memes on Instagram, which are very funny and also very political, but less, more, Instagram Reels is more of an echo chamber than TikTok and Twitter are.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair analysis, and I'm gonna get you on Noster as well, because I think you would appreciate it. And it's one of those things where it's a very young ecosystem, a young protocol. And so there's a lot of opportunity, I think, for folks that are using it early and using it well and being authentic on there to grow really powerful followings. Because ultimately, I think in the years to come, we're going to start to see other social media platforms just start to integrate with the Noster protocol as just a feature within their own platform, because there's going to be enough signal over there that they want to pull in. And it's just a feed that they can surface, you know. I'm also interested in the marketplace of algorithms that some folks are talking about on Noster, because to your point about being ruled by the algorithms, you know, the problem, because you're exactly right, but the problem isn't the algorithm itself, right? It's the opaqueness of the algorithm. It's the arbitrariness of the algorithm. It's the fact that somebody with the, you know, the control of that algorithm can very much sway opinion. And that's the problem. But if you have an open marketplace of open source algorithms that anyone can contribute to, you know, just free market, choose what algorithm you want. What how do you want to be served this content? What kind of content? That gets a lot more powerful, because it puts the hands back in the, or puts the power back in the user's hands. And I think that's something I don't know if we'll see that from centralized platforms, but it would be. It would be nice, but until then, at least there are some parallel systems that I think are very useful. But Sam, I want to be conscious of your time here. Enjoy the heck out of this conversation. Appreciate the honesty and the peek behind the curtain. It's quite fascinating. Anywhere you want to send folks, I'll link your Twitter in the show notes. But anywhere else you want to send people?
Yeah, I mean it's same across the board. My TikTok, my Instagram, my Twitter, Substack, YouTube are all just Samuel Arms. Some of them might have an underscore in there because it wasn't available on all of them, but you'll find me if you look them up. Would love for you guys to give a follow. Then obviously follow this podcast if you aren't already. I've really enjoyed this conversation. You've been the man. I'm glad we can meet and connect at Bitcoin Nashville. One of the many benefits of still gathering in person. I think it's still, that's something that its usefulness, I don't think will ever go away. So really appreciate you having me on.
Amen to that. I, as much as I like the technology to be able to do this, you know, from across the country, there is nothing better than being in the meet space with people. So yeah, go to Bitcoin conferences or any conferences you want, or just go to the bar, or wherever people gather around you, but go meet people in person. It makes a difference. But Sam, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it very much. And yeah, looking forward to seeing how things shake out this year. Should be an interesting one.
Good deal. Thanks again.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. If you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, head to bitcoinpodcast.net/sponsor. If you're enjoying the Bitcoin Podcast, consider giving the show a 5-star review wherever you listen, or sharing the show with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care, but I always appreciate it. You can find me on Nostr by going to primal.net/walker. If you want to follow the Bitcoin Podcast on Twitter, go to @titcoinpodcast and @walkeramerica. You can also find the video version of this podcast at youtube.com/@walkeramerica and @walkeramerica on Rumble. Or just go to bitcoinpodcast.net/podcast and find links everywhere. Bitcoin is scarce. There will only ever be 21 million, but Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time to listen to another fucking Bitcoin podcast. Until next time, stay free.